Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, a graduate student in English, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is my co-host, Carl.
Hi, everyone. Carl Cranny, good to be back. I have a PhD in religion, and I've written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture.
We have two guests with us today. Suzanne, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Suzanne, and I have a PhD in literature, specializing in early modern drama, and teach college English.
And we also have Megan with us.
I'm Megan Kohler. I am mostly a stay-at-home mom, but I also write for the Deseret News.
And one of your articles was recently quoted by Elder Cook, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Today is the conclusion to our Barbenheimer mini-series. So we'll be talking about Barbie, the surprisingly deep 2023 summer blockbuster film about the plastic doll that everyone loves to hate, directed by Greta Gerwig. If you've been following all the hot takes, you know there's a lot of questions about what this film really means, and we've got some opinions on the matter. But first, our best book segment, where we each recommend one thing we are watching, reading, or listening to. I'll start us off. My recommendation today is for a book called Beehive Girl by Michaela Orton Thatcher. This is a release from BCC Press, and it's a book that's about a modern woman doing the first personal progress program from the church, Beehive Girls. And it is really interesting to see some of the things that are the same in what the church expected young women to do and some of the things that are very different. There's a lot more writing essays than there were in my personal progress. There's none of this one paragraph nonsense. You got to write an essay about four important women in the local church. Lots of interesting challenges she goes through and just lots of really interesting LDS women's history in there. A very fun book. Highly recommend Beehive Girl. Carl, what have you got for us today?
So I recently went on a vacation with my family, and Susan and I decided that we were going to start doing books on tape while we were driving down to Williamsburg. We rented a bunch of them out from the library, put it on my phone, Encyclopedia Brown, Little House on the Prairie. But the one we decided to start with was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And we have had a fantastic time listening to them. So my five-year-old son didn't really pick up on it very much, which I think tracks with his personality, but my seven-year-old daughter loved it. And we are now listening to Prince Caspian together at night. And so just the Chronicles of Narnia in general, obviously classics, but I love that I'm finally at the point with one of my kids where I can start reading these longer form stories with them and enjoying it together. And it also means that I'm going to finish the Chronicles of Narnia because I actually don't think I ever read the last two or three books. So going to be fun, but I'm enjoying The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. And as far as something I'm watching, without any fanfare, apparently, they started releasing episodes of The Wheel of Time Season 2. So for those of you nerds out there who were unaware that this is a thing now, you can go watch those episodes. And it's a show that we've already talked about and reviewed on this podcast that most of us liked well enough with room to improve. And I look forward to watching the rest of it.
Awesome, awesome. I'm currently writing something about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as a temple text. I'm very much into Narnia at the moment, so that's exciting.
We're going to do Barbie as temple text, too. If you're a Latter-day Saint hammer, that everything looks like a nail, right?
That's right. Suzanne, what have you got for us?
All right. I'm recommending one of my favorite reads from this summer, which was Divine Rivals by Rebecca Ross. I think it's technically classified as YA, but thoroughly enjoyed it as an adult. It is a fantasy. But it's like World War I level, and it's between these Greek adjacent gods. They're not actually the Greek gods, but something akin to that in this fantasy world. But the crux of the story is actually a love story that is basically a you've got male premise. It was romantic. It was wonderful. And the author is clearly in love with writing. Like, she just loves writing and people who can write well. And so it spoke to me on so many levels, and I really loved that book.
Okay, Megan, what have you got to share with us?
My husband and I just finished watching Live to 100. It's a Netflix series about longevity. And I thought it was really interesting because they talked a lot about the role that religion plays in longevity. And I guess I expected a little bit and maybe mention spirituality and talk a lot about diet and exercise and lifestyle, but they didn't. They talked specifically about religion, about how that played a key role in all of the populations that had a lot of longevity. And I thought that was really fascinating. And then as far as books, I recently finished. I read A Time to Build by Yuval Levin. And it was one of the best nonfiction books I've read in a while because it's not a downer. It's actually something that's very actionable. I think you can have a sense of hope because it does analyze what's going on and we all know what's going on. I can just point to everything, right? But it gives some advice about what we can do that would actually help. So that made it stand out to me.
I just pulled that up on the Google and the subtitle is From Family and Community to Congress and the Campus, How Recommitting to Our Institutions Can Revive the American Dream. That's a lot for one book. That's exciting. I like it. No small steps here. Okay, we'll have links to all these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. And buying through those links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and beautiful in pop culture. We wanted to shout out also a recent episode from one of our fellow Public Square Media podcasts. I figured since we're doing an episode on Barbie, it would be appropriate to do something on womanhood. And Sit Down with Sky and Amanda had a recent episode on the redefinition of womanhood, reclaiming womanhood. They always have really thoughtful and engaging things to say about really difficult topics from a faithful perspective. So we encourage you to listen to that episode and think more about the role of women in our society. And now on to our main discussion of Barbie. So are you guys all Barbie diehards? What's your history with Barbie?
I have none.
Thank you, Carl. We appreciate that.
I love Barbie. I actually was dissuaded from seeing the movie because of there was just so much culture war around it. I wanted to see it because of how much I loved Barbies as a child.
I owned Barbies as a child, particularly the rollerblade Barbie, which do any of you know this infamous rollerblade Barbie that the wheels sparked? Like when you would roll them on concrete or carpet or anything, like it had wheels that let out little sparks and it got discontinued because it was totally a fire hazard, but it was really cool. And so I played more with the rollerblades than with the Barbie. That was the one and only Barbie I ever owned. I was never like in love with Barbie. I felt a little above her. I guess I was a little judgy of everything she represented, but also not a hater, not super hater. And so when this movie came out, I was sort of like, sure, whatever, fun, and did not expect it to be as deep and thought-provoking as it was, and was pleasantly surprised by that.
I'm probably also on that range of the Barbie experience. I had several Barbies growing up. We even had a Ken. We had a Prince Charming when I was young because Cinderella had come out. So we did have Ken, but I wasn't super into playing with dolls. The main thing that I remember is that my mom had an original Barbie with the black and white swimsuit in this trunk in our basement, and she would bring it out occasionally and blew my tween mind when she tried to explain to me that Barbie was originally this feminist icon and a very grown-up toy. And I just could not comprehend this, which plays into the movie a bit. I thought I would not want to see this movie, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was so well done. Visually, it's a stunning movie. They do a lot with the source material of Barbie. I think anyone who grew up, even seeing Barbie commercials, even if you didn't own them, you recognized things that were there.
They caused literally a worldwide shortage of pink paint because they bought so much of it for the production that the rest of the world had to wait till they had produced more. Anyway, I think that's just a brilliant little tidbit about the movie.
I loved that. I loved that there was so much pink. There was so much girly stuff in that movie. And I know that it's cool to hate that, but there were so many girls that loved that stuff. And then they had to hide it because it wasn't cool to like those things. And so I just love that the movie just completely embraced pink, fluffy, pretty things.
Yeah, definitely. I was one of those girls who did not wear pink on principle all through elementary school and middle school. And it took me a long time to be comfortable with wearing pink because I didn't want to be like a stereotypical girl. But pink is really pretty and all the Barbie aesthetic is really fun.
I was the same as you. I loved it. And then I had to pretend that I didn't for a long time. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I was like, this is dumb. I like pink. I'm going to have pink stuff.
Yeah, I'll say that I really appreciated how they completely combined femininity with feminism, that it was both. It was not giving up one over the other.
Yeah, and that can be hard to do, that balance. And I think we're going to get into this as we talk about the themes of the movie, like the balance between women can do anything, but also meaning women can choose to still be women as well and be traditionally feminine, and that's not a problem either. It's a difficult line to walk, and I feel like the movie did a good job with that particular line.
I think you're right. I noticed that there was one point in which the teenage girl kind of berates the Barbie doll for being all of those things, and she claims that Barbie set women back by being all of those things. And so that puts forth the question in the movie, did she really? Is that really a bad thing? Because this little girl seems really lost in the movie.
My father-in-law still won't go see the movie, even though we've told him it's really good, because he feels Barbie really did a disservice to women in terms of body image over the past 50, 60 years. And he lays that all at Barbie's feet and says, I'm not going to support Barbie because of that, that it was specifically the issue of Barbie's appearance. Which valid criticism. I feel like they could have done a little more with that in the movie. There was a little bit of a nod to that, and there's definitely an attempt to include more body types of Barbies in the film without really talking a lot about it.
This might be jumping ahead, but I thought that was actually one of the plot faults of the movie, is that early on I thought that was going to be the main issue. And I thought that because she had the flat feet and the cellulite and had to go to the real world to solve those body image issues. And I was like, oh, okay, this is the conflict that we're going to like really work through women's body image issues with Barbie. And then that's not what the movie did at all. There were some plot issues, but artistically, it was perfect. Visually.
Aesthetically, right?
Aesthetically, there we go. Aesthetically, it was perfect.
No, I think that's a good place to go next, Suzanne, because you're right that I don't think it's so much plot issues as it is theme issues, because there's just so much culturally wrapped up in Barbie, and the movie doesn't miss out on any of it. It touches on all of it, but it's not a long movie. This is not Oppenheimer with 3 hours of screen time to work with. They just can barely touch on some of these issues.
I got to a point where I thought that it might be better to think of Barbie, the movie, in terms of being a series of vignettes rather than one completely fluid narrative. And I think that you're right, Susanna. It wants to talk about all these different things, but it didn't really flesh out any of those completely. There's this great scene in which the mom character goes into this diatribe about all of these expectations that are placed on women, most of which are really contradictory, and how hard that is and how difficult it is. But there's really no further discussion of it and no resolution of it. And none of those questions are really addressed in the movie. So you just come away and be like, yeah, I'm angry about that. And then that's it. And I just thought, man, that's so powerful. I wish they had dug into that more.
I'm sympathetic to your point that it's a series of vignettes and that thematically it's a little all over the place, but I had a bit of a different reaction to it. So the opening of the movie is a clear reference to 2001: A Space Odyssey, which was one of my all-time favorite movies. And it was so pitch perfect. I was laughing so hard.
It was amazing. It's amazing.
I had to stifle my giggles because I was like, I'm being rude to the other people in the theater right now. Like, this was just so perfect. But one of the things I really like about 2001 is there's this big black monolith. And it's like Stanley Kubrick just says, here is a symbol. It's just a black rectangle. And so you can put onto that whatever you want. And is this a reference to God? Is it a higher intelligence? Is it aliens? Is it, who knows? It's just a black box, literally. So put into it whatever you want. Pour all your dreams and theories and fan fiction into that. It's fine. And in Barbie, I feel like it's similarly, it doesn't have just a, here is an obvious symbol. Please do with it what you will, the way 2001, I feel, does. But it touched on so many different things in ways that I found interesting and engaging and thought-provoking, it did a great job of saying being a woman is complicated and there are all these issues around women's power and patriarchy and the role of men and women and society and all these things. And we're not going to come down on any single one of those. Here are a bunch of symbols and vignettes. Although I feel there was a little more thematic coherence to the movie than maybe just a series of vignettes. But I'm sympathetic to that point. But here, we're just going to talk a little bit about all of these things. So you can pour whatever you want to into these symbols that we have bestowed upon you and create really interesting thoughts, which is one of the reasons I think the movie has succeeded so well, is it doesn't really come down on any side on a lot of these issues. And that leaves a lot of room for discussion, because I'm not sure there are really simple answers for everybody that's going to work for every situation. And that is a power of the movie. You tell your father-in-law, Liz. It gets the Carl Stafford approval. This is one of my favorite movies to come out in the last several years, actually. And I don't think I have to turn him on man card to say that. It's a great movie.
Carl, I agree that it's both a strength and a weakness of the movie, that everyone who watches it is going to have a different experience and going to have a different takeaway from it based on their own personal life experience, because it is a little bit that black box. It is a little bit, you can pick the theme that you want to follow through the movie and see where it goes. And some of it does go places you expect and some of it doesn't. And everyone's going to react differently to how that plays out, which is why for me, I do think it has some thematic problems, but I still think that it was a plot issue for me. The way I teach what a story is, a character who wants something and goes through conflict to get it, is a simplified definition of story. And it's just so hard for me to know what Barbie wants through this whole movie until the very, very end. But what she wants at the very end doesn't seem to apply to anything she went through to get there, right? The whole battle of the patriarchy didn't necessarily apply to Barbie's personal conflict of figuring out who she is. That was Ken's conflict. Anyway, so I saw Ken wanting something and Ken going through conflict to get it, but that wasn't supposed to be the main story. It was supposed to be Barbie's story. Anyway, all of this is just to say that I felt like the plot was not coherent as far as telling a really good, cohesive story. And that's where I felt like the movie disappointed me. It was so funny, though, on a scene-by-scene basis, and so thematically interesting. There didn't seem to be one conflict that was clear from the beginning that got followed through and resolved in a coherent way.
I agree. I think this is part of why Megan's calling it a series of vignettes, why you have problems with the plot. For me, I guess the one place where I think the vignette and the overarching plot, if we can call it that, did come together is in what we talked about earlier with the diatribe from the mom about how complicated it is to be a woman, where in the plot, that's what snaps the women out of their subservient roles in the patriarchy that Ken has so hilariously brought back to Barbie Land. And I liked that theme, that the solution is not just to return everything to Barbie Land the way it was, is to recognize the complicatedness, and that snapped them out of it and led to a more positive outcome. I guess when I say it never came down on anything or on any particular side of any of these issues that it brings up, the one that I felt was a little thematically almost out of place was that the solution to all of this is to go find yourself, and then I guess it's going to all work out. And I don't know where that came from, but the movie ends with that point, and I think I agree with you, Suzanne. That's the solution? I wasn't even aware that was an answer to any of the questions that we have asked ahead of time. And when I liked the solution isn't patriarchy or Barbie Land. Can we call that matriarchy? The solution isn't for women to run everything or for men to run everything. The solution is to recognize it's complicated, and that was really nice, and then they went to go find themselves, and I was like,
I think Ken's story actually ends up being the more interesting one, but then having the less interesting resolution.
Yes.
One of the things that bothered me about the Ken storyline is that we start out with Ken being superfluous, right? And he's almost fulfilling the role of women in a stereotypical world, right? He's just an accessory. He's there to look pretty and be there when Barbie wants him and not when she doesn't.
Right,
and
his name is Beach Ken. He's like, my job is Beach. It's not even to beach. It's not even a verb. It's just my job is beach. I'm Beach Ken.
But then when he goes into the real world, suddenly Ken morphs and is in the male role there. And so it's a little bit confusing because then he brings back patriarchy. And is that trying to say that Ken in the female role brings back and now they're in charge and it's worse? It just doesn't quite work for me. There's some kind of transition there in the symbols where it didn't quite follow, even though it's hilarious, Ken's understanding of what the patriarchy is. It's also interesting that the patriarchy isn't quite as ridiculous as we think it is, because Ken gets turned away from the hospital, right? Part of the point is that our world is patriarchal and Barbie doesn't understand it. But it's not completely patriarchal because they still recognize that Ken is not competent to do anything, even though he's a man. So there's an interesting statement that our world is not the patriarchy. It's not Barbie land either. So it is somewhere in the middle, which I did like that part of it.
I feel like the patriarchy that Ken sets up in Barbie land, I feel like that is the culminating point of the story. And while I think that there are a lot of things that sort of reflect back to you, whatever your priors might be, in this instance, it does seem to be saying something about men in particular, which is that they are at once stupid, but also that they want power and that if given the opportunity, they will take power. That seemed to be, to me, a fairly unambiguous point of the movie. And I guess I thought that was disappointing because it was a caricature of a cultural trope. And I'm not sure where anyone was going with that in the movie, but I think what most people are going to take from it is that men are dumb and men want power.
That's interesting because as the only male on the podcast, to me, it felt like it was men want to be appreciated and his relationship with Barbie in Barbie land in the original conception of it is so obviously one-sided. Oh no, I'm going to have girls' night because every night is girls' night. You just stay at the beach. It's not even clear where the Kens live. Do they just sit there like people in the Truman Show waiting for Barbie to show up and start acting, right? So anyway, that was the thought that I took away is that he wants to be appreciated. If she had even, I don't know, once a month or something hung out with him, it would have gone very differently. And so that's the inversion, of course, of the way so many relationships in the real world are, or at least that's attempting to say that the women is just underappreciated. The joke about the guy who comes home and is like, geez, what do you do all day? You stay at home, mom. And then one day she doesn't do it. He comes home. He's like, what happened? I didn't do all the things you say. We have these stereotypes here and it just, all it does is gender bend them and flip them on their heads. I don't know. I thought Kent was hilarious. And
he was hilarious.
To me, it was not, men are stupid, although that's mostly true. And men want power, although, again, I think that's mostly true. But the heartbreaking part of it was so obviously that he just wanted to be, like, respected and a true partner. And Barbie was not giving that to him. And so he comes back and ruins everything with the patriarchy. Hilariously.
Yeah, which ends up flipping it to be exactly the opposite, which is why I find it strange that people read this movie as saying that women don't need men or that men are superfluous. I think it's saying exactly the opposite, that things are terrible when only women are needed and men are superfluous. And things are also terrible when only men are needed and women are superfluous. There's the implicit statement that we need both and that we need them to be different. And there's a reason that we have both. Which I really like that message.
So Liz, I can see how people actually go to this movie and see when the women are in charge, it's really great for the women. It only sucks for Ken. And it is a utopia for the women. And yes, Barbie starts having those dark thoughts, but those are thoughts and negativity that's coming from the real world. It's not coming from her experience in Barbie land at all. So see how some people see that portrayal in the movie and think, oh, the message is that when women are in charge, life is great for women and that men would deserve this. Men would deserve a taste of their own medicine. Men would deserve to feel neglected or to feel unappreciated the way women have felt through most of history under patriarchy. And I get that it's such an extreme portrayal of it that it is a critique of it, but I can also see how someone who's not really reading the subtlety of that critique could see just this sort of, because it is that scene where all the women vote and restore the matriarchy, essentially, of Barbie Land, it really is so gleeful and so exclusive of the Kens. The Kens are not there to vote, and the Kens don't get a say in the restoring of the Barbie Land utopia. And so the message does seem to be, or at least I can see how some people would take that to mean, this is the way that the utopia should look with women calling all the shots, even though there is inherent cracks in it. They're just a little too subtle. I think that's why men come away from this movie saying it's a man-hating movie, because the subtle critique of that extreme Barbie Land feminism is subtle.
I think I can agree with you on that point. I forgot about the election issue. And it's interesting because that election, we're restoring it by distracting the men so that the women can fix things. That directly contradicts the message at the end with Ken, you need to find yourself and be a whole person. But how is he going to do that in Barbie Land? There's no way for that to happen.
There's still no place for him in that society to be appreciated, which is what he has wanted through the whole movie, to be appreciated.
And we have Barbie also leaving at the end. So it's interesting that, like, yes, we restored Barbie Land, but Barbie Land, actually, we need to leave Barbie Land and we need to change Barbie Land. Contradictory, definitely.
And this is what I was looking for from the movie too, right? This idea that feminism is an answer and a solution to all the problems of patriarchy, but the feminism that they portray is a flip, right? And not necessarily the equalizer, at least not in practice, right? Like, it doesn't show an equalization in practice. And I think part of that was because they really didn't want to have Ken and Barbie end up as a couple together at the end. Like, they really resisted that. And I get why they resisted that. I get that there is very much a cultural moment where we are not wanting people to be defined by relationships and wanting Ken to find himself as a person without Barbie. And the same for Barbie. Little girls should be a person without a man, right? And I understand the value in that message. But then that tied them into the knot of not being able to present the solution to patriarchy, which is not the flip, it's the equalization. It's men and women working together in committed partnerships. That is the equal solution to patriarchy. But the movie couldn't go there because they wanted to preserve this message of not having Barbie or Ken be defined by their relationship to each other.
Maybe there will be a sequel and they can get together and we'll solve it then. That would be an interesting two-part movie. To me, this whole conversation reminds me of one of Hugh Nibley's great essays. If I can take a moment and just read the last paragraph of Patriarchy and Matriarchy, where he basically says, neither one of these is a good answer. This is stupid. This is not God's kingdom, even though we have so much literal patriarchy in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and even in some of the phrasing in the temple ceremony and stuff. But I think Nibley's got it right here when he says, so one must choose between patriarchy and matriarchy until the Zion of God is truly established on the earth. It is that old devil's dilemma in which we are asked to take sides with Gog or Magog as his means of decoying us away from our true dedication to that celestial order established in the beginning, which, of course, in the context of his speech and essay is Adam and Eve, the primordial couple. Yeah, this is also a place where I think they tripped up. The solution is to have the men and the women both vote together. This is obvious, but the movie never portrays that. And there's never a moment where we have the working together. There's just Barbie Land, which is either pure matriarchy or then pure patriarchy. And then we have the real world, which is complicated, and that's it. And in the real world, the only men that are there are all the CEOs of Mattel, and then the husband, who's
got one scene.
In one scene. He's in two scenes. He's learning to speak Spanish in one scene. And then at the very end of the movie, he helps drop her off at the doctor's appointment. And that's all he does in the real world. Sibley is right. The devil is making us choose between should women be on top or men be on top. The correct answer is, to borrow Elder Ballard's term, councils. Like, where we all work together.
I want to make a point that I think maybe resolves that tension a little bit that we've been discussing, where we don't want to be relational beings, but at the same time, we want equality. And I think that part of this whole discussion revolves around this idea of power being something that's like statutory. It's something that we delineate and we codify, and that's what is power. And if you think about power in terms of influence, I think that you start to see how important relationships are, because relationships are how influence manifests. And so I think we have this conception of power. It's just really sparse because we're missing that relational aspect. And by the way, when we think about power in terms of influence, and not just in terms of prominence, we see that the idea of matriarchy and patriarchy also doesn't make a lot of sense. Like the idea that because women have not occupied as many prominent positions as men throughout history, that therefore they lacked influence, right? That they weren't shaping the world that they lived in ways that suited themselves as well as other people, in ways that helped other people. We don't really have a vocabulary for talking about that, so we miss all that. So the idea is that women, because they were doing these things that we don't value, they lacked power, they lacked influence. And I'm not saying that women shouldn't occupy positions of prominence or that they shouldn't have these political delineations of power. I think that is important, but I think it's bad if we, because of that, forsake the way that influence manifests relationally. Because women, we're all relational, but I think women are particularly, and that is one area of influence in which women, you know, typically, I think women are stewards of relationships even more than men. So if we don't count that, then yeah, women are oppressed. I was thinking about that like the whole time I was watching the movie.
No, I just think the relational aspect is definitely something we're missing in that conclusion. And it's difficult to make it come across if you assume that we don't want Barbie and Ken to end up together. There's no other way to demonstrate that relationships are important. Sure, Barbie has a relationship with this human family at the end that we're going to drop her off at her doctor's appointment and help her become a real person. But that's not the same as being in a family. Friendships and family are different from each other qualitatively. And
I totally had that thought. I was like, is Barbie living with them now? And that's a little weird. Is she independent in the real world? Or I don't know.
Unclear. But it is interesting that we have this diatribe of problems of being a woman. The solution is, of course, other people have pointed out, a very Eve's choice kind of solution, that Barbie chooses to fall, to become real instead of idealized, to accept this contradiction, basically, right? She says, yes, there are contradictions, can't solve them, but I'm going to go experience them. And without our pain, we couldn't have had joy, which is good. That's definitely a very Latter-day Saint message. But there is the missing part of everything after that being relational. For example, people frequently say when they're interpreting the film that Barbie's creator, Ruth, is like a God figure, which she is. She created Barbie. They play the Sistine Chapel type moment for all it's worth. She's a God figure. But there's no indication that Barbie is going to have a relationship with her God figure after she chooses to fall. This is not a part that continues on. So there's just this somehow being an individual and seeking our true self is going to solve all of our problems. It's going to solve all of Ken's problems and he can stay a Barbie, and it's going to solve all of Barbie's problems in the real world. It reminds me of C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, where he says one of the devil's biggest tricks is to get people shouting fire when there's a flood. So it's not that finding your true self is a problem. This is an important thing. Is it really the case that we have an epidemic of people not finding their true selves? Or is it the case that we have an epidemic of people cutting off their relationships and not understanding how to relate to each other and being lonely? Which one is the real problem in the world right now that's causing our problems with each other and with the relationships between men and women? I think it's probably the relationship problem and not the we don't know who we are problem.
Yeah, I don't think we can know who we are without relationships.
That makes no sense. Just thinking in sort of a science fiction way, if there were just a baby in a vat of goo who grew up never interacting with anybody else, how would he ever become self-aware? We have to be relational beings in order to come to know ourselves.
There is no self without the other.
Yeah.
The existence of the other that defines self.
I don't want to take away from this point, or I want to come back and talk about more about relationships and the value of relationships, but I was just going to say that one thing that helped me forgive the movie for not presenting a relationship between Barbie and Ken as the answer. Not that it had to be the answer or the solution, but
part of the answer.
Part of the, yes, the idea that men and women could work together and have positive, co-equal relationships of some sort, even if it wasn't romantic. One thing that helped me forgive the movie for not going there, assuming that they ever even wanted to, is the fact that clearly this movie is constrained by its commitment to representing the way Barbie is played with by real little girls. And Ken does not matter to real little girls who play with Barbie and Ken. Ken's around, Ken's there, but he does not matter, right? And there's this great story with an interview with Ryan Gosling, who talks about agreeing to take the role after seeing his daughter's Ken doll in the mud next to a squashed lemon and just being like, this is how little girls play with Ken. Ken is absolutely the neglected figure. So for the movie to stay true to the universe of how little girls play with Barbie and Ken, they really couldn't end up. He really couldn't ever matter. So I can forgive the movie for holding fast to, yeah, little girls really don't care about Ken all that much. But I personally wanted them to get to the actual solution between men and women, which is, yeah, relational.
It reminds me of an essay I read years ago by a feminist writer who was talking about how she did not want her daughters play with Disney dolls. Except that by the end of the essay, she talked about how it was inevitable her daughter got one at a birthday party or something. And she ended up with a Disney princess doll and was there with the Prince Charming. And as this feminist mother watched her daughter play, all right, Prince Charming shows up, we get married, and now she's going to go have a tea party with all of her animal friends. And she just chucked the prince aside and he was done. His role had been fulfilled. And at that point, the feminist writer was like, I'm okay with this, actually. Funny to see the reaction there.
Is this from Cinderella Ate My Daughter? That's what it sounds like to me.
It's been so long, I don't remember where I read that.
It started out as a journalism piece and turned into a book. And the book is fantastic for like exploring Disney culture. It's more Disney culture than it is Barbie culture, but Barbie's part of it.
It's been so long, I don't remember where I read this. I just remember the basics of the story. And I may have gotten some of the details a little wrong, but the point is the prince shows up, you get married, and then he is superfluous and useless and doesn't ever show up in the girls playing again.
Exactly the same way that the hot girl shows up in the action movie and they get together and then we save the world and who cares about the hot girl anymore.
And I was just thinking, okay, when do girls stop playing with Barbies? I think it's right around the same time that they start thinking about boys, like in real life. And Ken represents this time in girls' lives where men are not romantically interesting. And we definitely see that through the movie. So many times when poor Ken, yeah. He's just not the apple of Barbie's eye.
Which I thought was so funny because they make it very clear that they are both anatomically incorrect humans.
Yes.
In this hilarious little moment. And everything Ken's doing to try to be with Barbie. But I'm like, but where is that coming from? If they don't, I don't, again, it's very Adam and Eve. If Eve eats the apple, she comes back to Adam. She says, okay, I've eaten this. We have to go now because, oh, by the way, you're naked. He's like, what? I don't know. It's an inversion of that.
No, it's like the way little girls think about things, right? Because at one point, I think I'm supposed to stay over and she can do what? He's like, I don't know. But and how you think about it as a child, you're like, you don't know. You know what adults do, but you
have
no idea.
We're supposed to get married. That's it. That's all we know.
Yes, you're supposed to get married. You're supposed to get a house. And I don't know why we do these things, but we do that.
Yes. He's the symbol of a man. Yes, he is great.
He is the most sympathetic character in the whole movie.
And we have to give a shout out to his song and to that moment. The choreography, that is like the, hands down, my favorite moment in the movie. That whole scene, it was so reminiscent of like old Hollywood songs, like singing in
the ballet number.
Like that. Yeah, and just fantastic choreography. And it was so over the top, ridiculous, and amazing, amazing performance there.
Yeah, shout out to Simu Liu too for being the other Ken. All the actors, everybody just did such a great job in this whole thing. I thought, I'm like, Will Ferrell, what are you doing here? But you know what, I wouldn't have cast anybody else as the CEO of Mattel. And then they even break the fourth wall. Note to the writers, if this is the point you're trying to make, do not cast Margot Robbie in this role.
Indeed.
Ugh. So many great moments like that, just little moments that were so funny.
my thought is just the Matchbox 20 song. That's supposed to be like a generational joke because they're like millennials and I don't know, maybe a lot of the audience is millennials or something. I couldn't figure out what that was about.
So the joke I heard is that Gen Z was shocked to discover that song was like a real song that we listened to on the radio and took seriously as a song in our, and it wasn't specifically written for this movie. I've heard that younger generations are like, wait, what? That song wasn't written for this movie because it's about, I want to push you around. What? We were okay with those lyrics in our day and nobody criticized them in our day. Yeah, that I think that's the reaction I've heard towards the use of that song. Okay, I know we're getting short on time, but I feel like we got through a good discussion of patriarchy without addressing the super big elephant in the room, which is how women feel about the patriarchal system of the church and all of the comparisons that I've seen to the Ken's patriarchal system and the Mattel CEO and board comparisons to apostles and just that this is a quote-unquote problem in the church and a lot of people, a lot of women in the church who have issues with the patriarchal leadership system and can point to a show like Barbie to say, see, this is why our church structure is wrong and bad.
And I have actually seen quite a few people make that very point.
I think one of the questions I came away from this movie asking myself was, what is the difference between patriarchy and the patriarchal order? Because we believe in patriarchal blessings. We believe in this kind of thing. And it's difficult to explain that the difference between a problematic kind of patriarchy and the patriarchal order, which is something we believe in, because I think we can have both in the church. There are definitely leaders who abuse their power, who look down on women. I've seen that happen. That's not something I'm going to deny exists in the church. And yet I still believe also that the order of the priesthood is important and it's something that matters. And we can hold both of those contradictory concepts together, just like the Barbie film can hold many contradictory concepts in itself. But it is interesting. So what do you guys think? What's the difference between the ideal patriarchal order and patriarchy as it sometimes exists?
I'd like to go first and then just shut up because that just
sounds good, Carl.
This between this and our one on where the crawdads sing, I'm sitting here, oh dear, I don't know what my role here is in the podcast at least for episode. But this is something that Megan was talking about earlier about how we buy into the world's definition of power and influence. If you're not the president, if you're not a senator or a Supreme Court justice or whatever, you don't have power or influence. And that is not the way the gospel would have influence exist. When Megan was talking about that concept of what power is and what influence means, and if you don't have this particular definition of power, you don't have any influence, which I think we all realize is an oversimplification, but it's straight out of section 121, right? No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, love unfeigned, kindness, pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul without hypocrisy and guile. It goes on, and even just today in my personal reading, I read 1 Corinthians 11, where it talks about men are the head of women, but love them the way Christ did, and he died for the church. And at least in that sense, I would hope the difference between patriarchy, which is just ruled by men, rah, and the patriarchal order.
Horses,
that's right. Yes. And the patriarchal order that we believe in, although maybe we need to come up with a better name for it. The vocabulary here is very fraught, but that to me is the major difference. Is what kind of influence you have and how you exercise it by being like Christ, who will return in power and great glory in the worldly definition, but was a lamb the first time he came and he died for it. But the secret, of course, is because he was so in tune with God, he didn't stay dead. And now we have all that other glorious future to look forward to.
Carl, I think that you just articulated what I was trying to say so well. And to add to that, I think the way that Christ has shown us both through word and deed, the way that power works is through love. And when I look at the priesthood structure of the church and the way that men participate in the priesthood. I actually see men being required to adopt those methods of influencing other people through ministry. We think of the priesthood, I think, as that's when a man is in a visible role making decisions for everybody else. And there is some truth to that. There's a lot of truth to that. But I think if you are looking, if you're peeking behind the curtain a little bit, what I see there is this process by which the Lord educates men and teaches them that the real way to affect good and change in other people's lives is through tenderness, is through listening, it's through personal ministry. And I think it's fair to say that these are things that traditionally women have not needed as much external formation in order for them to affect that. I think women naturally understand that method of influence. And I think it's an unfortunate that instead of valuing the way that women influence, we have said instead that the real way to do things is fill in the blank, the way the world does things. And we should, and women should do that, or else women aren't valuable.
Okay, I have two thoughts. And one of them is, along the discussion, both of your discussions with power and it being wielded righteously. I've been thinking recently about how the ideal governmental system that we have right now, we think of democracy as our ideal governmental system where everyone votes together. But the second coming or a paradisical government system is actually going to be a dictatorship's not the right word.
It's a monarchy.
It's a supreme monarchy, right? Which only works when the supreme monarch is Jesus Christ, right? Or God, like a perfected being. And I see that in our patriarchal system as well, right? There is lots to critique about how power is used in the world by unrighteous, imperfect people. But when the system is inhabited by people who are trying to be righteous and trying to live up to Christ's standards, no one really does suffer under that system, right? No one is going to suffer under the monarchy of Christ, and no one suffers under righteous leadership, right? Where the critique of the church comes in is that sometimes we do have fallible leaders because we are fallible humans. We are not Christ. But my second thought here goes back to our earlier discussion of the relationship between men and women being the answer, and something that totally transformed my view of how the priesthood and how patriarchy works in our church and in our doctrine was actually, I don't know if any of you have read The Priesthood Power of Women by Barbara Gardner. You guys seen this book? It was a really powerful book for me because she describes how the current church system of prophet, 12 apostles, this patriarchal order that's restricted to men has only been around since post-Christ time, right? It was set up after Christ and is only meant to be for this earth life. It is not an organizational system that continues on into the eternities. The organizational system that continues on into the eternities is that true patriarchal system of husband and wife, right? The organization in heaven and in the eternities is husband and wife together. That's the original organization of Adam and Eve, or we can think of Abraham and Sarah, that the family is the original organization and it is the eternal organization. And the priesthood is not just the church leadership. The priesthood is men and women being sealed together in the temple, right? That is the epitome of the priesthood. And that women really are not excluded from that at all and will not be in the eternities. That it is a co-equal power that is shared and a co-equal leadership of the family organization. And recognizing that is our doctrine, that is actually our doctrine, was really profound for my testimony of understanding that maybe we have an imperfect system here in the ecclesiastical order of our church, but it's not the eternal system. Just like how we do believe in consecration too, but we're not perfect enough for it yet. We have imperfect systems right now, but the eternal system is far more of a solution to all of our problems.
I have one more thing to add to that. I really loved both of your thoughts. And just one more thing that I wanted to add is something that my mom told me when we were talking about the temple and going through for the first time. My sister was going through for the first time, and she is single. She was not getting married. This was back when you made a covenant to obey your husband. And the difference emotionally between making a covenant to obey your husband when you don't know who he is and a covenant to obey your husband when he is a real person that you have a relationship with, and that feels a lot safer and a lot more real, and like can understand and you trust this person. And so it doesn't feel the same as generically a man, a Ken, who knows who this is. And I feel like it's the same way for me with church structure. And maybe it's harder now that we are a bigger church, that we do not have the same kind of personal contact with the higher leadership that people used to. Like even in the 70s, like people could just like write to the apostles and expect a personal letter back and like really have this closer relationship. And so sometimes I think a lot of our problems and a lot of the problems with feeling like the higher up church leadership is unfeeling and patriarchal and they don't understand has to do with the fact that we don't see them as people. And when I've talked to people who've given presentations to the Quorum of the 12 about difficult issues, and they just uniformly tell me these people ask really deep questions. They understand what's going on. They understand things. And just that feeling of being safe with these people when you know who they are, as opposed to seeing them every 6 months giving a conference address. That's something that's really difficult in a big church. But I think the more that we strive to know these people, the more we can trust them in ways that are hard when it's an abstract concept.
I wanted to push back a little bit on something Suzanne said. This is me being a little more feminist than the women, maybe, and that's okay. It's good. People aren't harmed if everybody is acting righteously. I suppose the feminist critique of that, one that I am sympathetic to, would be something like, is there some kind of harm merely by not being represented in the councils of the church at the highest level? And I find that an argument that I resonate with, which is why I am glad that, especially in the past 10 years or so, the church has made good strides to make sure that there are multiple women on all the major councils of the church, the Division of Tithes, the Missionary Council, anyway, all of them have women there. And as Elder Holland mentioned, and we no longer ask them to leave and then finalize our decisions. And so that's good. I also think the temple ceremony, as it has evolved and changed, has achieved more parity with that goal that you talked about, Suzanne. This is where I'm agreeing with you. I'm pushing back on that one point. Is there harm in not being represented? I'm sympathetic to the idea that there might be some. But now the temple ceremony no longer has a covenant to obey. It's not even a covenant to hearken. Now it's a covenant to counsel together. And I think we as a church are also evolving in our understanding of these things. And I recognize that for women in yesteryear who went through the temple, it was very damaging to some of them. And I find that, again, I keep using this phrase, but I'm sympathetic to that. But I'm glad that we're doing better now as a church at getting towards that ideal of the eternal family, because that the eternal father, the eternal mother, that is what our ultimate goal is. And that's where Barbie, to get back to the movie, utterly fell short for me, because it was so obvious what the answer was, but then for whatever reason, they just couldn't do it. And so it turned into a, now go forth and find yourself, which might be useful a little bit, but finding yourself is not the permanent long-term solution to all the problems that the movie so brilliantly put in front of us.
So Carl, just to say, I think we actually do still agree, because there have been plenty of times where I've had the thought, oh, if I were in the room where decisions were happening, I would have things to say. And I wish that I could be in the room. I want representation.
The room where it happened. Okay.
Exactly. But I think it's the idea that the church leadership is progressing, is recognizing that women do need a voice in higher decisions, and that they're moving towards that, and that they're not necessarily holding this hard line on Paul, women should not speak in the church kind of thing, right?
I don't think he wrote that verse.
We don't need to get into Paul. I'm just saying that I think that's what gives me hope, or just being at peace with the structure the way it is. As Liz was saying, I do have faith in these men that they're not out to hurt women and that they are actively working to include women's voices. And I respect that. And I don't think the system is perfect yet. There's always room for improvement and always room for change. Just that when there are good people in charge, there's hope for good things to happen.
Okay. Anything else we didn't cover that we should get to before we move on?
I think the motherhood discussion, I think you only come away with this idea that motherhood is weird and we don't really want to be part of it. Because at the very beginning, it starts out with these little girls pretending to be moms. And then Barbie / feminism / whatever she represents comes and crushes that, right? And then there's this scene where there's pregnant. Is it Midge that's pregnant?
Midge, yes.
Yeah, she's pregnant. And that's just awkward and gross and weird. And the camera wants to pan away really quickly. There's the also there's like that sort of a relationship between the mom creator and Barbie that just goes nowhere and doesn't feel that important in the movie. I don't know. A lot of weird messages about motherhood.
I've talked to people who feel like it was more motherhood positive than I personally felt it was. But like we mentioned earlier, maybe you go into Barbie and you see what you are looking for. I'm always looking for messages about motherhood. And I feel like there were some nods to, like, you can be a mother if you want to and not have any pressure to be an astronaut and a president at the same time as being a mother or whatever. But it felt like a nod to motherhood as one thing among many rather than like motherhood as a special role of women.
Feminism has a super long and complicated relationship with motherhood. And it has definitely evolved from the 70s where they were like, motherhood is awful for women and women should not become mothers. We have evolved past that because their point being that, and I've experienced this in my own life, that it's not my husband who oppresses me. It is my children. My children are like the oppressors. They are the tyrants in my life that drain my life force and energy, right? No, love them to death. I love my children to death. And I would not change a thing. But
as the stay-at-home dad, I support this message.
Children are energy vampires sometime.
Yes.
1,000%.
That is early feminist relationship with motherhood is really draining on women and really does not allow women to be individuals and be themselves. And it is a fair point. And it really is hard, the turn that feminism has allowed of now we can have it all, right? Women can be president and mothers, right? But I mean, that is not a great answer either. The way this movie portrays feminism as not offering us perfect answers. It is not a perfect answer to say, oh, you can be whatever you want and be a mother. Yeah, we're slowly evolving to motherhood can still be a part of being a woman. But yeah, feminism has historically done a poor job of recognizing and celebrating motherhood as an intrinsic feminist experience.
Yeah, and I think the movie went a little further in that the final scene with when the Ken Barbie thing is getting resolved, the mother does ask for, it would be great if you could just like be a mom, a normal mom, and you don't have to have career aspirations. I don't have to want to have it all. I really preferred Gerwig's Little Women for this. Like, I really loved her take on Little Women, which maybe we should do an episode on that. But specifically the scene where Joe is like, you know, my dreams, but I'm so lonely. And just like that recognition that like you can't have it all and maybe you chose wrong. Maybe the more important thing was to be in a relationship. I really liked that message in Little Women, and it wasn't quite as strong in this movie as I would have preferred if I was making Barbie, but I was not.
There were a couple of moments in that montage sequence where there were like women playing with their kids. Those were the only kids in the entire movie.
Besides the kids at the beginning.
The girls, yeah, with the apes from 2001, yeah.
So I feel like we cannot talk about feminism and the church and even Barbie without talking about Valerie Hudson, because she actually has written a review about this movie, which I won't go into, but she also talks a lot about women in the church and the role of motherhood. I was just going to say, one of the things that Valerie Hudson talks about a lot is when feminism tries to disconnect women from motherhood, it separates them from women's unique, powerful contribution to the plan of salvation is the one role in which women are completely indispensable. And if you have the full picture of the restored gospel, then you know that it's also an incredibly significant contribution which they make, which is completely undervalued. And so we have set things up so that instead of saying, no, the thing that women do, that's really important, we're instead saying women should do what's really important, which happens to be all these other things that men have typically done. And I wanted to bring those thoughts in from Valerie Hudson, because I feel like this whole movie is talking about womanhood, and yet it talks a little about motherhood. That's going to necessarily limit the discussion in ways that I think make it really difficult to talk about the power of women and the value of women's contributions.
So I agree with the motherhood being an integral part of a feminist experience and a feminine experience and our contribution. Just thinking in terms of the movie and what it can do, right? I find this a little bit easier to forgive in just that she is a doll without the
a uterus.
I mean, without a uterus, right? Without the ability to reproduce. And I can also understand their impulse not to make that a driving force for her wanting to become a real person. Although I do think, again, in that montage, that there's hints of one of the wonderful things about becoming a real person is this potential for a relationship with a daughter someday, because there are so many mother-daughter moments in that. It's definitely, again, so subtle that it can be missed, or one of those things that maybe I'm just reading into it that other people wouldn't read into that message. But I don't know. That's just my thought on the movie not focusing on motherhood too much. It was unfortunate that they made the pregnant doll a byline, a joke. Yeah, Midge was a joke and was called creepy. That was unfortunate. Although at the same time, it is a little weird, the pregnant doll. But I wish they would have handled her differently in the movie.
Great. What would you have had them do with Midge?
That is a good question. Just maybe more speaking lines, just have her and say things about being excited to have her baby. I don't know, simple things that could have made
her. Or maybe not introduce her just to comment on how weird it is that she's pregnant.
Yes, right. Even if it is strange, but to have her have just maybe a little bit of a personality that's, I'm so excited for the baby, and have the other women around her be excited for the baby too. I don't know.
I get the constraints with her being a Barbie, but I do think that's unfortunate. That movie reflects that we can't have that discussion. And I think this is even in the movie, a big part of your imagination when you are a girl is motherhood, caring for babies and the things that you see mothers do. And I totally can see why that wasn't really addressed and why having a pregnant Barbie, yeah, that's really weird or something.
At the same time, there is a lot of mother-daughter relationship in the movie, right? Just like the real mother and daughter in the movie.
Yeah.
And there are quotes about mother-daughter relationships and this weird, not fully developed theme about the role that Barbie plays in that mother-daughter relationship. It didn't come to any sort of satisfactory point that I can really articulate, but there was this idea, girls play with Barbie in order to envision what they're going to be when they grow up, and mothers played with Barbies when they were little, and it's something to relate to their girls about. It's not that mothers were completely absent or motherhood as a theme was completely absent. It just was one of those themes that I feel like they didn't have enough time or plot to fully develop in a satisfactory way.
Especially if your ending thesis is going to be, go find yourself in solitude.
Right.
I guess that wraps up our discussion. We're going to move on to the rating segment. We give everything we watch 3 ratings. Our first rating is for content, clean versus objectionable material, which we do on a celestial, terrestrial, telestial, outer darkness scale. Where would you put Barbie? I was hesitant when I found out that my 12-year-old niece was going to this. I don't know. What do you guys think in terms of content? There were definitely some pretty, I wouldn't say explicit, but blatantly sexual jokes about Barbie and Ken.
That was actually one of the things that surprised me about this movie is how much it was geared to adults and not children friendly very much at all. My 6-year-old daughter asked to go and I was like, nope, it's actually, she's like, but it's about Barbie. How can it not be for me? And I was like, it's not. It's not a movie. It's not a movie for the girls who actually play with Barbies currently.
I didn't even think about how upset I would have been as a child to not be able to see the Barbie movie.
Just put on one of the thousands of them on Amazon. They'll be fine. I wouldn't put it celestial for me. Maybe terrestrial, because it's not like it's really explicit. Like, it's no Oppenheimer.
It's not terrible. I would rate it terrestrial as well.
Same.
I think that's where I land. Yeah. But yeah, it's an interesting question. At what age do you think my 16-year-old niece saw it with her mom and dad, and she hated it? And I thought that was, and part of me was like, I don't know if you're, even as a 16-year-old, I don't know if you're old enough to get what's going on in the movie, which I thought was interesting. So apparently not 6 years old, 16, at least in the case of my niece.
Okay, our next rating is for artistic merit on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls. Thought. I think this movie deserves quite a lot of popcorn balls.
I was going to say, so 5 is the best?
5 is the best.
5 is the best, and I'm going to give this one 5. This was unabashedly one of the most interesting movies I've watched in years, and I had such a great time watching it.
I would have to say 5 as well.
I'm going to go lower. I am actually only giving this like 3.5 and maybe 4. It gets knocked down for me for, if we count plot as part of artistic merit, the failures in the plot for me knock it down. But visually, aesthetically, lots of other notes, it is fantastic.
I sympathize with that, but I had such a fun time, I'm still going to give it 5. I just had such a great time with it, but I sympathize with your concerns about the plot and the themes and how it doesn't quite wrap up. I kind of rate for personally about on what they're going for. And since this to me was going for, let's start lots of conversations about all these themes, and good job. Mm-hmm. But that's just me.
Just, I came away from that movie like wanting to go back and play with Barbie dolls again. I loved the Barbie world so much. I just spoke to the little girl in me that just, you know, wanted that pink car and wanted those shiny plastic looking accessories. They brought that to life so unbelievably visually and physically. The characters were so good. Margot Robbie is just like a really stunning Barbie. Yeah. I mean, you just laugh. You just laugh so much.
It's true.
I think I might split the difference and go with 4 popcorn balls, not because it's not a super entertaining movie that I will definitely watch again, laugh at again, and really enjoy. I worry that it's going to be a little bit culturally dated because it uses so many of very online phrases in our discourse about things right now, like white savior Barbie. Like, is that going to hold up? I don't know. So I wonder if it's going to be as much of a classic where it holds up over time, or is it just like peak 2023? This movie was like built for this cultural moment. It revels in being for this cultural moment, but it's going to be hard to contextualize in 10 years. There's valid reasons to have both a movie that's of its time and a movie that's a classic. So it's not like we can't do it. I just wonder, I'll be back in 5 years and see if I would give it an extra popcorn ball. And our final rating is for gospel connections or morally edifying messages on a scale of 1 to 5 apricot. Anyone want to go on this one?
That's so funny.
Lots of gospel connections, but were they morally edifying connections, right? This theme of go find yourself is not bad, not the most morally edifying place to land, in my opinion. So I guess that means I'm giving it what, like, 2, maybe 3. I don't know.
Always difficult to differentiate between the messages the movie is putting out and like the discussions that it can start. This is definitely a 5
if we
apricots.
We rate on discussions, it's much higher.
Right. Yeah. Apricots for starting discussions, for having something to say that's strong and coherent, maybe not so many apricots. I go 3 on that scale, I guess.
Yeah, I think I'd probably be a 3. And, you know, I talked about some of the things that I thought, some of the points I thought it made that seemed a little disappointing to me. But there's no question that there's a lot to think about from a gospel point of view. And that's not something that a lot of movies can even point us to these kind of existential questions. And so even though I'm giving it a low number of apricots, I would still recommend it to a lot of people just to get them thinking about those questions, because I feel like to have a popular, like, Hollywood movie be able to draw that out is really rare.
I think we all agree that it asks some really good questions. I'm going to give it 2 apricots myself because it doesn't really supply answers. We've talked about that, but the answers it does supply aren't very gospel-based. So great for conversation. Although, man, Barbie is temple text, like the whole primordial innocence leaving the Garden of Eden to go into the lone and dreary world. Like, it's just saturated with so much sort of temple stuff from an LDS perspective. But yeah, I'm going to give it 2 apricots. Great questions. I don't really necessarily like any of their answers in as much as there were answers. So 2 apricots for me.
If you want to hear a great podcast discussion of Barbie as temple text, you can check out the aforementioned title on the podcast Face and Hat, Jepsen's podcast, both episode on Barbie as a temple text. And it was very fun. So
we put that in the show notes.
Definitely. You can follow my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com. Carl, where can people find you?
I'm still on Twitter, and I'm going to call it that until it dies. I'm at Carl Cranny.
Suzanne, where can people find you?
They can find lots of book reviews and bookish content from me on Instagram at suchstuffbooks.
It's a very fun feed. I highly recommend. I follow. Megan, where can people find your stuff?
They can find my articles at Deseret News. And I keep my Twitter updated with the things that I publish. And my handle is at TreClare, TreClare.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice or on YouTube. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this episode via email, social media, or on our website. It really makes our day when we get to hear from you. I know everybody's got opinions about Barbie, so send them our way if we didn't cover your opinion. Carl, can you tell us what we'll be discussing in our next episode?
All right. Next time, we'll be discussing season 2 of Star Trek Strange New Worlds. We covered season 1 on the podcast last year, and we're going to pick up the conversation from there. The show follows the crew of the USS Enterprise in the years before Kirk and Spock and all the original series crew that we have come to know and love. So be ready for that conversation next time.
This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.
Welcome to Sit Down with Sky and Amanda, where we're navigating a divisive world as two Latter-day Saints in a mixed orientation marriage. Church members will approach us or message us and ask, what can I do, basically, regarding this issue? What can I do to help those who identify as LGBTQ feel welcome while also holding on to the doctrine?
On this podcast, we are faith-affirming first. We discuss the latest trends in LGBTQ activism, how we can take a faith-centered approach to hard issues, and how to avoid letting toxic, modern ideas seep into church culture. It's very interesting to me how much hatred and vitriol we get for our marriage or for some of the things that we say.
We release an episode every month. Join us for our latest episode. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or follow us on social media.